my good friend Glenn. Thank you very much for coming this morning. And I'm sure Glenn's dealing with an emergency. So to continue with the perspectives of global perspectives and the things that are going on this planet, and Dr. Bob Correll is here today to share with you the work that he's done. He's been an old colleague of General Warden's when they worked together in the White House early on. So the White House in the past has been very progressive in climate change and other issues. Bob Correll has a distinguished career as a leader in oceanographic research, a variety of other domains. He also served in the National Science Foundation as the vice administrator, or deputy director for all of the geosciences area. And so a lot of the satellite specifications that went up were based on Bob's leadership. In the polar arena, he was, a couple years ago now, was the chairman of the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which is a cooperation amongst over eight nations. And he brought into that perspective the inclusion of indigenous peoples into the science domain. Previously, scientists had said, well, we're the scientists, and we're not going to talk to the locals. He embraced the reality that the people that are living there probably know an awful lot, and so began the dialogue, which will also continue tomorrow morning when we have folks here. So Bob brings dimensions to this that aren't typical of what we think of as scientists. Now he's the leading the climate change research program at the John Hines Center for Economic and Environmental Studies, and so very active. I'll tell you, he lives on airplanes. He's running around the world helping major treaties on climate change and global cooperation, and I'd like to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Bob Correll.
As usual, Tim overdid it. I'm delighted to be here, and I also want to commend him for his tenacity to bring this process along over the last several years, including the New Zealand meeting. And what I'd like to do is talk to you this morning a little bit about both two dimensions, the scientific challenge, and I include the policy challenge. And the reason I include it is it seems to me that the next step for all of us in this wonderful scientific and knowledge community to be able to take what it is we know and move it across some very difficult barriers to action, because many of the things we now have fairly high confidence on require us to think pretty clearly about the next steps. So let's focus first on some of the long-term time series. Many of you have seen this, I'm sure, but I want to point out a couple features. Actually, this record has now been documented to about 650,000 years, and we actually have the data set to 800,000 years. But as you well know, carbon dioxide levels are now well above anything in that 650 and probably well above anything we've seen in a million years, increases of the order over the highest peak of about 30%. And the projections of IPCC and others is that we're headed to something in the 400, 500, 600 category. We'll talk more about what that means later. But look down at this period. If you look back, none of the interglacial periods have had this stability. Most of the interglacial periods have been characterized by status at that level for a few hundred years. And as you'll see here, we've had that period of stability for 10,000 years. And some of us, including the anthropology community, would argue that this stability, that the variability in the temperature on the planet, less than a degree in the either direction, has facilitated the growth and evolution of humanity as we know it. But we've seen things like the Little Ice Age, which was a pretty powerful time, as well as the medieval warming, and of course many historic events, the birth of agriculture almost 10,000 years ago. And much of what we know about humanity is buried in this 10,000-year period. Prior to that, we're looking at Cro-Magnon and other forms of the evolution leading to humanity as we know it In fact, Cro-Magnon were still in southern Europe 12,000 years ago. So this is the area that I call anthropologic sweet spot or humanity's sweet spot, and I want to talk more about that a little later. So if you look at the IPCC record, the time scale on all of those graphs is 10,000 years. And you can see that in the far right on all of them, whether they be carbon dioxide, methane, or nitrous oxide, the three most powerful greenhouse gases, they've all exploded during this industrial revolution, let's call it the last 200 years or so. If we look more closely, the famous set of diagrams that get called the hockey stick have been maligned on many fronts. This happens to be what I consider the best piece of work by Moberg. And it does give us that variance, but you can see the instrumental record is now pretty clear as to what's happened over the last couple hundred years. But again, let's look at that little area there and see what's happened over the last 125 years or so. And we did have that relative cooling effect in the 1940s to 1970s. A lot of discussion about why that is so. Possibly one of the better explanations I've heard is it was in that period where there's massive changes in particulate matter in the atmosphere and the introduction of such things as the Clean Air Acts, not only here but elsewhere. But it's probably still going to take some time to sort out that. It's probably got a lot of natural variability buried in it as well. I consider it like climbing a mountain, relative rise in a little valley, another rise in a little valley, and eventually you get to the peak. But there's no question you're going to the peak, and that's clearly the case over the last couple hundred years. If you look at the IPCC, every single diagram you want to take on a regional basis or landmass, oceans, all of them are in this time scale since 1950-60, all on rapid growth curves. And the last IPCC, which was released over the months of this spring, uses words like unequivocal, that things are happening. So let's go on and look at what that might mean. And let's talk first about the oceans. The oceans are the flywheel. They're the thermodynamic engine that drives and controls in many ways the time scale and magnitude of climate change. And the reason for that is that the imbalance of energy that comes into the planet, 90% of it ends up in the ocean. What we talk about, the melting of glaciers, the warming of the atmosphere, and the reduction of sea ice all occurs within that 10% slice. So the ocean obviously has to be looked at pretty carefully. And Tim Barnett and a group have done, I think, one of the more important tasks to help us sort out natural from anthropogenic causes. This happens to be using the Hadley model, but several other models were used, including the parallel model at Los Alamos. And if you ask the following question over the last 40 years, if there had not been an increase in anthropogenic factors, and that includes not only greenhouse gases but the cooling effects of sulfur dioxide and things of that nature, and knowing pretty well what's happened to the atmosphere and the planet in terms of solar variation and internal feedback mechanisms, if you look at these three buckets of the ocean, by the way, they exist for the southern oceans as well, the computer model said that the temperature distribution should be in the blue range, somewhere in the blue range. If you run the same model and then let all of the anthropogenic factors that we know about greenhouse gases, again, sulfur dioxides and things of this nature, back into the equation, then the computer model said that the ocean temperatures ought to be in the green zone. And then if you then go back and do the millions and millions of data sets that we have and bucket them into these oceans, you get the red dots. And the correlation between the actual data and the green computer models in all six ocean basins and in all of the models we've run, the confidence levels are in the high 90 percentile region. Tim likes to call this a silver bullet. I think it's probably one of many bullets that we need to be able to nail down the anthropogenic factors. But you can see the divergence. You can also see that the oceans warm very, very differently. The North Atlantic is barely warmed down to 100 or 200 meters, whereas the North Atlantic is well down into the 700 or 800. And it is this warming that gives rise to one of the elements of sea level rise, and that is very simply as the ocean warms, the ocean expands, and there's only one place that it can expand, and that's upward, and that contributes to sea level rise. And this is the dominant play in sea level rise as we know it today. In this century, the melting of land-based glaciers and land-based ice masses will also begin to overtake that and maybe even exceed it. And that's a meter of sea level rise for South Florida. Now, let's talk about the thermohaline circulation or the oceanic conveyor belt, the Wally Broker's idea, which I think is pretty well documented now. Some very important things happen in North Atlantic, and that is the water at that point becomes among the most dense water on the planet, both because evaporation has caused it to be more salty, and as it goes further north, it releases that heat that makes Northern Europe so much warmer than our part of the planet, the same latitude. The diagrams are much more complicated than that simple. It's more like a spaghetti diagram, causing these processes to occur where this heavy water sinks and then returns on the bottom to the North Pacific. But we are already seeing a reduction of the salinity of that region. You can see here that there are regions that are much less salty, and that then worries us about whether the stability of the thermohaline circulation or the conveyor belt will retain itself. Our models aren't good enough to give us some projections, but clearly not on the time scale.